From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. The hustle and bustle of the big city, for many of us, it's a daily aggravation. For William White, it's his laboratory. White studies how people in urban areas interact with each other and their surroundings. William White talks about the vitality of city life on today's Fresh Air. Also today, we meet poet and novelist Al Young and his alter ego, O.O. Gabuga. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews two new recordings featuring conductor Sir Thomas Beecham. And Leslie Savin examines the glasnost of advertising. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. A generation has come of age which thinks of the shopping mall as the town center. William White doesn't much like shopping malls. He prefers the vitality and spontaneity of city streets, and he's spent the last 20 years studying how people interact on city streets. White's study dates back to 1969, when the New York City Planning Commission asked him to help write a new city plan. His subsequent research has included countless hours walking the streets of New York, watching how people use them, and studying films of city life shot by his hidden cameras perched high above the city streets. His findings are published in his new book, City: Rediscovering the Center. Over the past 20 years, White has served as an urban planning consultant for many major U.S. cities, where he's challenged the conventional wisdom about how to revive urban centers. You might also know White as the author of the now classic 1956 book, The Organization Man. It was about the dilemmas faced by those who worked in the corporate world, people who surrendered their individualism for financial security. I asked William White why it's so important to him to make sure that we keep urban centers alive.
Well, they're the center of the metropolitan area, and they're very important for suburbs. I grew up in a suburb, small town. It was about 25 miles west of where you are now, east, I should say, west, yes, Westchester, Pennsylvania. And the fact of Philadelphia was tremendously important for all of us who lived in that small town and all the other small towns. It's where you derive your sense of where you're at, and all of the great metropolitan areas have a wonderful sense of directionality. So I don't see this as a case of the small town or the suburb versus the city. They need each other.
Mm-hmm. I think that you've observed that a lot of planners have designed or redesigned cities based on false assumptions. So you've been trying to find out how people actually use the city so that planners can plan according to reality. Is that right?
That's right. One of the things that's happened in about the past 20 or 30 years is that we now have a new generation of planners and architects and whatnot, most of whom have never known what it's like to be, what it's like to see, for that matter, a good, old-fashioned, thriving downtown. I have very vivid memories of Philadelphia, for example. And to me, that was part of the thing that was fun in life.
You started doing your current research during a period when planners thought it was very important to relieve the high-density population in urban areas, to relieve some of the pedestrian traffic. And what you found in your study was people actually really like crowds, or at least they gravitate to crowds.
That's right. To me, the most fascinating piece of research we ever did, I was thought it would be a very fine idea to find out when a couple of people meet on the street, old friends and whatnot, and of course, naturally, they're going to get out of the way of the pedestrian traffic stream. And my thought was that they would move right to the lee of the building. And I set up time-lapse cameras and recorded what they did over a long period of time. To my surprise, I found that they were moving not away from, but into the pedestrian traffic stream. And the longer the conversation, the more apt it was to be smack in the middle. So people talk one way, but there is this tremendous impulse to centrality.
Mm-hmm. So people actually hold their conversations right in the middle of a crowd.
Yes. Well, watch the next time you're in a reception or a cocktail party or something like that. Watch how, as the evening progresses or the afternoon, how they tend to cluster more and more in the smaller spaces, with other spaces left absolutely empty.
Now, a lot of people in cities think of the street vendors as a nuisance because they take up so much of the street, you have to walk around them. And a lot of the merchants are opposed to vendors because the vendors sometimes undersell the merchants. You found that vendors actually play a pretty important role in
cities? I think we've got to make distinctions.
Okay.
But you got some pretty rascally vendors. There's no question about that. But even the ones who sort of wink at you and sort of let on that this is stolen goods, it's not stolen goods usually. They're special houses that are specialized in that merchandise. I have a very mixed emotions about the dealers. I think it's terribly important when you're talking about street characters, street people, to make distinctions between them. And this is what a lot of business people, and retailers in particular, don't do. So they will see, let's say, a harmless street performer, and they will classify him almost as though he were a dope peddler. There's a tremendous difference between these people. And you take certain kind of vendors, I think, perform a rather real function. Food vendors, for example. Here in my city of New York, they're caterers of the outdoor life of the city. And every time that they get shooed away from plazas and whatnot, it's interesting how the life of the plaza diminishes. They're I think, basically a very important influence.
What kind of vendors do you think are a problem in the city?
Well, dope, of course. This is, well, since I started my research, two things have happened. One, I think the dope thing has gotten much worse. And there was dope around, you know, 20, 16 years ago, certainly. Now, they're omnipresent, and it's a terrible scourge. Then, of course, the other thing, which is different, but nonetheless equally a scourge, and that is the homeless. And I must say that I am floored by the question, what do we do about the homeless? And it's had a terrible influence, not only on the homeless themselves, and it seems to me certainly on our conscience, but also for any kind of program. Every time I talk to people about, let's animate this particular spot or this park or whatnot with events, you always come up against this problem of, what about the homeless? And we don't have a solution for that.
Well, sure. A lot of people designing public spaces, small parks, little plazas, are afraid that if they make it comfortable, if they're seating, that it will just become a home for the homeless.
And it's that belief. It's that belief that's the problem. Because it doesn't happen to be true. I beg your pardon. That if you make a place very, very attractive, you're going to attract a lot of homeless. Curiously, in a perverse sort of way, I'm not talking about so much about the homeless now as I am about street characters and street people. In a perverse sort of way, they stay away from places that are well-liked and well-used by most people. And so to me, it's tremendously encouraged for all these problems that you go to a wonderful small park such as Paley Park, Greenacre Park, these lovely little things, and you think they'd be run over with homeless, they'd be run over with all sorts of dope deals, and they're not. They're not. They're a place where you see great displays of civility. So I think it is true that if you make a place that's comfortable for people, that doesn't solve the homeless problem. It doesn't solve it, but it's an awful lot better than what so many people do in so many cities. And then I said, let's make it uncomfortable for the bad people, and they stick spikes in ledges, and they make ledges too high to sit on, and all that kind of thing. It's ridiculous. It's very immoral, for one thing.
So you've even found a lot of plazas and public spaces where seating has been removed to discourage homeless people from staying there.
Yes, but by the same, let me cite sort of the opposite sort of thing. I think of the Philip Morris people. They sort of like the city, people that run the Seagram building the same way. They're not in the slightest exercise over the fact that maybe some morning they look out there and there's a bum, you know, sleeping off a hangover or something like that. Their feeling is, okay, as the day wears on, the bum won't be there anymore. And what the question they ask is, well, the sun rises, you know, life goes on. They don't worry about it. They're very urban.
If we follow with your finding that the best solution for a public place is to make the place attractive for everyone, what kind of public space seems to be attractive to everyone? What recommendations do you have to designers of public spaces?
Well, the first thing I do is tell a designer, spend some time at the busiest street corner in town. The greatest open space in a city is a wonderful street corner. Because the most important ingredient of a successful place is a great mixture of people. And this is one of the first things I noticed when I sort of stood out on the streets or started taking films was to me, surprising number of chance encounters, old friends running into each other. And I saw this happening day after day with a frequency which really floored me. And I began to realize that this was not accidental, that this really was a actuarial probability. When you get a good, tight downtown, and all the great downtowns are tight, that is, most of them have a good, tight grid pattern, the chances are that you're going to run into a lot of people that you know. That's one of the great attributes of a center city. It's much more social, you know, than people realize. Now, you ask about what other kind of spaces. I think the small urban park, this is a personal bias on my part, the small urban park is an utter delight. By that, it could be, well, I think of Paley Park in New York, which is all of 42 by 100 feet. Now, that's a very small space. And curiously enough, it attracts, well, on a nice day, you'll get about 180 to 200 people sitting there, sitting, mind you. Now, that is a very strong, that's a very high density. And Paley Park and Greenacre Park in New York are the two places that are most often cited for being, very comfortable, very relaxing, not overcrowded, quiet, and so forth. In actual fact, they're rather noisy. They're usually crowded, as a matter of fact, of places that you go to voluntarily. They are the two most crowded places in New York. But they have a number of sort of standard ingredients which seem to me rather surefire. There's a water wall, makes a wonderful sound, sort of masks the street sounds. Most important, they are removable chairs all over the place. Not one has ever been stolen, by the way. They have a wonderful canopy of honey locust foliage overhead. Very deceptively simple in a way. Oh, incidentally, always a nice little food counter. And they're a wonderful place to stop or to meet somebody and say, well, why don't we have a cup of coffee at the park?
Mm-hmm.
It's a lovely place, lovely place.
If you're just joining us, my guest is William White, and he's a consultant to city planners. He was the author of the 1956 book, The Organization Man, and his new book is called City, Rediscovering the Center, and it's based on about 20 years of research he's done on how people use the city streets. Now, you point out that in a lot of successful public spaces, there's a mayor, you know, either the vendor or a newsstand operator who's there in the same spot every day. Everybody checks in with him when they get there. The mayor knows a lot of people by name. Does that serve a certain security function?
Yes, it does. It's security. I think more important than the security in the sense of bad people and stuff like that, more important is a sense of belonging, which we all enjoy. It's a sense, this is my city. So the one that guy says, hey, Doc, put on a little weight there, aren't you? I mean, you're being recognized by a regular. It's a rather comforting thing. And I've noticed in talking a lot with people who, when we talk about how they use the city, what things they like, what things they don't like, this is one of the great attractions, going somewhere where they're known. It may be the familiar stranger. You don't know the name of the news dealer or whatnot, but the guy is, oh, good evening, how are you? Boy, it's cold, and so forth. It's a wonderful little moment of the day.
Mm-hmm. You've told us some of the successful designs of public spaces. What do you think are some of the worst mistakes designers of small parks and plazas have made?
The worst mistake they can make is to shut it off from the street. Now, the most usual way of shutting it off from the street is a great big wall. We've seen quite a few of those. Or they may sink it, you know, down 10, 12 feet to get them away from the bad people. But the wall is the worst of all. And almost invariably, these places are dog places. Nobody uses them very much. Bryant Park in New York is a beautiful park with these lovely, lovely old trees and whatnot. But it was built on the idea that let's protect people from the street. So lining the street facade of the park are, one thing is elevated, about 4 feet above the street, are fences and shrubbery and so forth. And the thing has always been a flop. People haven't used it very much. And there's now a very heroic and, I think, extremely intelligent effort to redo the park. And the main thing that is being done, quite aside from the band concerts they're going to have and the restaurants and all these wonderful things, is they're bringing it back to the street. They're cutting down all sort of the things that make it difficult to wander in there on impulse. And all the great spaces, you sort of move from the street into the space without quite realizing that you've made any transition.
You make a plea in your book for more public restrooms. And I think anyone who lives in a city or works in a city would share your interest in having more public restrooms. But then the problem is, once there are public restrooms, you're afraid to go into them because you're afraid you'll encounter muggers or dope dealers once you get inside.
It's a very real fear and very in many cases, very justified fear. I would qualify and say that we really ought to come back and have more restrooms. I think that they have to be attended to really work rather well. And that calls really for sort of a municipal restroom. I was very struck in the discussions about making City Hall in Philadelphia a much more, you know, lively place for people and have it sort of a gathering place for the citizens. And one of the certainly one of the finest things they could do. They have plenty of room in the restrooms in City Hall, sort of large and dark, is making a point of having really good attended restrooms, and also restrooms with that wonderful and very, very important thought in mind, restrooms for mothers with children in tow.
I want to ask you something else about the way the homeless population has changed. There's so many people living on the streets now. And I was wondering if in your observations of how people use the streets, if you've observed how they deal with homeless people, whether whether most people try to ignore them, pretend that they're not there, walk around somebody who's sleeping on the street, or whether they're stared at, they're spoken to, they're given money to, or have you observed these things?
Yes, I have. Very tragic thing. I think they're pretty much taken for granted. They're part of the furniture now. They weren't, you know, about 4 or 5 years ago. You do have to step over. And a lot of them are, we've greatly swelled the ranks of beggars. When I started my research, the beggars that I studied, that I saw, were by and large professional beggars. That was their livelihood. And you saw them every day in the same places. The kind of begging that we see now, but the greatest in numbers, are the homeless with their poor, pathetic cups. And I think that we feel terribly uncomfortable. We're reminded of things we felt we shouldn't be reminded. It's a hell of a problem. It's a hell of a problem. And well, the fact that we sort of take them for granted is one of the worst parts of it.
Begging has gotten a lot more aggressive
yes.
lately, and a lot of people who ask for money on the street have this implied threat, you know, that if you don't give it to them, that, you
yes.
know, they could hurt you if they wanted to.
Yes.
There's frequently that implication now. And I wonder how you think this is affecting the way people use streets, because I think a lot of people have become more concerned about their safety on the streets.
Well, theoretically, they should. You would expect to see a diminution of street activity. I keep fairly good records of the number of people out on the street, which is, incidentally is a very overlooked tool. If you want to find out what places people like and what people don't like, just count the number that are using a certain place. I have not noticed any diminution, really, in street life. And I think that I'm speaking sort of as one who lives in New York, and we seem to have the best and worst of everything at times. And I think this is just sort of part of the scene. And I'd say with a good bit of callousness, unfortunately. But I don't think it has had a very drastic effect on street life. I'll tell you the really drastic effect on street life is in the smaller cities, which have lost their nerve. They've lost, they've lost their sense of importance, their sense of uniqueness and whatnot, and so they try to fend off things like the homeless by erecting suburban shopping centers downtown where they don't belong. In other words, fortresses. And they say, look, let's attract the middle class back from suburbia, and the only way we can do that really is to offer them security from the city. In other words, to entice them into these fortresses, and it doesn't work. These things mostly go bankrupt.
Well, in a moment, I want to talk with you more about why you think that suburban-style shopping malls in downtown cities are a bad idea. But first, we're going to take a short break. My guest is William White. He's knows a lot about urban planning, has been studying how people use the cities, been studying this for around 20 years, and is author of the new book, City Rediscovering the Center. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is William White. His 1956 book, Organization Man, was a groundbreaking work that brought to light the mechanized rituals and routines of corporate culture. Over the past 20 years, White has been studying how people use the streets and open spaces in cities. His new book is called City, Rediscovering the Center. Well, we left off with your criticism of suburban-style shopping malls built in urban centers. What are some of your objections
to these
city shopping malls?
Well, the main thing is they deny the street. And if you go out and take a look at a suburban shopping mall, you'll see they're mostly blank walls. Well, that's not so bad out there. That's rather functional. There are no passersby to attract with display windows, because there are no passersby. You made the decision to go into that mall when you drove your car there. You get in the cities, and pardon me, it's an entirely different thing. And you do need impulse. You do need those windows. But most of all, you need the look of retailing, the look of the busyness of the city, people buying things, people selling things out, you know, available from the street. You don't get this in a suburban shopping mall that is transplanted to downtown. And to a rather surprising degree, these things, particularly the very large ones, Renaissance Center in Detroit is an example, the very large ones have either gone bankrupt or are near it.
Mm-hmm. You talk about how disorienting it is inside some of these really large malls, where you look at one of these You Are Here maps,
Yes. And
you see a dot, and the only thing you could tell is that I'm here in front of the pizza chain. Well, you still feel really disoriented.
Yeah. Where's here?
Located
Where's here?
That. Yeah. And then another problem, I guess, is that if the shopping mall takes a lot of the street traffic and moves it inside, do the streets become less safe by virtue of having less traffic?
Yes, they do. This is one of the most distressing things of all. There's a terrible price to be paid for turning your back on the street. And what happens is, so I'm going to oversimplify a little bit, but you get a sequence that runs like this. People say, let's put in a couple of overhead walkways to get people off the street, and so they'll be safe, and also so they'll be warm in these terrible winters and so forth. So they put in a walkway and then another walkway, and then they put in their sort of shopping along the second-level walkway. And so pretty soon, they have a very vested interest in getting people up to that second level, or in any event, within this complex rather than out on the street. So the next step is the blank wall. And it's no coincidence that the cities which have done the most to get people off the street, you know, put them up in overhead walkways or down in subterranean walkways, those particular cities are the ones who have now started lining their downtowns with blank walls. St. Paul, Minnesota, a wonderful city. Now, you walk downtown, you can't see it in anything except blank walls.
But do you think the streets are less secure when a lot of the people have moved inside?
Yes, certainly. Mm-hmm. Actually, let me say one thing about Center City security. This is a very live subject whenever we're talking about downtown. The curious thing is, and I've kept pretty good records on this thing, the downtowns of most American cities are the safest places during the time that people use them.
Mm-hmm.
There are very little. I can think, I know pretty well what's happened on most of the plazas here, and there have been two incidents in about the last 16 years, really serious incidents. There was one killing at Bryant Park, and there's a couple of other things I know about. But by and large, they're quite safe places. I'm not talking about dead of night, because you'd be foolish to go there.
Well, you also object to how inside megastructures, which are the mixed-use places that are part hotel, part shopping, part office, part restaurant, how those and the shopping malls control behavior inside. Impromptu street performers aren't allowed in. People with handbills and pamphlets aren't allowed
in. I've just come from Cincinnati, a wonderful city. It has one of the great public squares in Fountain Square. They also have a new atrium, an indoor area, part of the Westin Hotel there. And part of the deal was that they were going to, in exchange for getting to build, you know, hire their hotel, they were going to make a big public place. Well, they didn't do it. And this is characteristic of what is happening in many cities. You see, if you're a nice middle-class person, you're well-dressed, that's all right. They don't give you a hard time. But what they really want are shoppers. They want middle-class people. And they shoo out other people. And I think that should be against the law, for one thing. But I think it's also very short-sighted. You can't have a public place and get all the benefits of having a public place, and they say, well, we're only going to have those members of the public that we approve of. One of the great geniuses of a city is as a place where people come together, and that includes, unhappily, but necessarily, some people we don't particularly like.
What recommendations would you make now to urban designers who are trying to revive their downtowns?
I'm going to repeat an answer that I gave to a similar question a little while ago. They should go and spend some time on the street, most particularly a street corner, to see how the place really works. And I think they will discover some things that can make their planning much better. And I go back to the time when I first started doing my work on the city. This was the time when everybody said the great problem of the city is this crushing density. There are too many people. Let's get the people off the street. And an awful lot of very terrible things were done to cities. Whole sections were razed, you know, demolition. That's when I think my lord for good old Westchester, Pennsylvania, which did not have its downtown destroyed, but many, many communities did. And part of this came from nobody paying attention to how people really worked. The public housing projects, for example, it was quite obvious the way people, what they preferred and what they didn't, that they liked two-story, low-rise, public housing far better than they did those gross towers, you know, one right after the other. And yet year after year went by without the lessons being applied. I think the core of the problem is a failure of the part of our planning and design mechanisms and outfits to check back on the ground how people are actually using the city.
If you recommend against urban shopping malls, what alternatives would you recommend?
Well, I think the city as it is a pretty good alternative.
Mm-hmm.
Let me just pick off. As far as, say, shopping streets, the best shopping streets are not in malls. They're Madison Avenue and here in New York. They're, good old Chestnut Street. Well, it's not what it used to be in Philadelphia, but it's coming. Newbury Street in Boston. Now, that's very cheesy. That's very sort of high style. But the city is a great place for retailing. It's really it's one of the hearts of the vitality of a city. And that's why having these great big interior fortresses is a denial of the great function of the city. And I think that one way to say, what is the function of the city? Yes, it's come on some very hard times in Philadelphia, and particularly one thinks of North Philadelphia, and I remember all the great manufacturing plants that used to be there. Cities have been losing manufacturing. This is gone in many places. They're even losing computers and high-tech stuff. That's going out to the suburbs. That stuff is already out there. But as the city has been losing out on a lot of its previous functions for which it's no longer really able to discharge them, as it's been doing that, it has been reasserting its most ancient function, and that is as a place where people come together face-to-face. And that's the true genius of the city.
One last question. You've spent so much time not only observing city life through hidden cameras, but also hanging out on street corners, watching people interact. Were you ever arrested as a loiterer?
I never was arrested as a loiterer. Funny thing, though, you know, for somebody standing taking notes, it just drives a lot of other people crazy. And the minute I go to a place, I won't be there more than 5 or 10 minutes. And all I'm very, I try to be as unobtrusive as possible, taking notes over my researchers. Almost invariably, somebody comes in, hey, buddy, what are you doing? Do you mind telling me what you're doing? He's a regular of that particular block. They want to know what you're up to. The dope dealers I really worry about, because often, you know, you aim a camera somewhere, and chances are, whether you know it or not, you're getting a dope transaction. I've had some dope dealers come after me. I'm scared to death of that. But by and large, most people are reasonably frank. They want to know what you're up to. The idea of somebody standing in one place just observing is a very freakish behavior from their point of view. But I've enjoyed it. And one last thought, it's wonderful for one's ego, because after a while, when you get to know how people are going to act, that probably there's 100% conversation, they'll move into the center of the traffic stream, or that there's a couple that are saying goodbye and they've just had a failed goodbye, you can be pretty sure there are going to be two more goodbyes before they actually part. And once you notice how they react, you begin to get the feeling that somehow, because you can predict these things, you get the feeling that somehow you're causing them. You know, it's a wonderful thing. They're not, of course. The people, it's quite in it, but I get the feeling that, my people. And when I see them do these things, it makes me feel good.
You live in the city yourself?
Yes, I do, up on 94th Street.
Okay. I want to thank you so much for talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you.
William White's new book, City, Rediscovering the Center, is published by Doubleday. White also works as a consultant to city planners. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with poet Anne Waldman. She's known for her lively performances of her poetry, and she's been a key figure in the second wave of poets who came after the Beats. For 9 years, she directed the St. Mark's Poetry Project in Greenwich Village. She's now the director of the Writing and Poetics Program at the Naropa Institute in Boulder, Colorado. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Al Young was once told that his writing wasn't militant enough for a black writer, so he created a militant alter ego. Coming up, we meet Al Young and O.O. Gabuga. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews two recordings from this century's most famous British conductor, Sir Thomas Beecham. Lloyd says these recordings show both Beecham's mastery and his musical sense of humor. And guest commentator Leslie Savin examines how Pepsi goes down in the Soviet Union and how that plays on American TV ads. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. Inflation rose sharply last month on the retail level. The Labor Department reports that the Consumer Price Index increased by 0.6% in January. Michael Richards has more.
January's upturn in the Consumer Price Index was the largest monthly increase in 2 years, and it brought the annualized rate of inflation so far this year up to 7.2%. Independent economist Michael Evans says there were four special factors pushing inflation higher.
One was a huge increase in tobacco prices, 4.7%. Another was a big increase in gasoline prices. A third was a big increase in food prices, and a fourth was a large rise in certain types of service prices that generally only jump once a year.
Evans says these once-a-year increases won't affect inflation next month, and since wholesale food and energy prices seem to be leveling off, he doesn't expect inflation to be as high on the retail level next month when the figures are released. For National Public Radio, this is Michael Richards in Washington.
Investors reacted negatively to today's Labor Department report. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell more than 42 points. The Dow closed at 2284.11 on volume of 165 million shares. Iran's Ayatollah Khomeini today said trade embargoes and other sanctions launched against his country because of the Salman Rushdie affair are useless. Khomeini is refusing to rescind his death sentence against the British author. At the same time, Iranian President Ali Khamenei warned that violence will spread if the novel Satanic Verses is not removed from bookstores. In Canada, the revenue minister, who has refused to ban the Rushdie novel, has now been provided with 24-hour security after death threats were made against him. The number of Central American refugees turning themselves in to the Immigration and Naturalization Service in South Texas declined dramatically today under a new detention policy. NPR's John Burnett reports.
Yesterday, more than 300 refugees sat under big green army tents waiting their turn to apply for political asylum. Today, by noon, there were only about 30 applicants. The reason may be because of the 233 applicants who were processed yesterday, only two, both Nicaraguan men, were recommended for asylum. The other 231 were locked up in a minimum security prison 25 miles west of Harlingen in deep South Texas. Advocates for the refugees contend that news of the INS's new detention policy is out on both sides of the river, and aliens are afraid to come forward. Some will go the illegal route, paying smugglers to take them farther north. Others, say the advocates, will cross into the United States through Laredo or as far west as San Diego, where the border is not patrolled as heavily. Meanwhile, the INS is interpreting today's low turnout as evidence that its new policy to discourage frivolous applications is already working. In Harlingen, this is John Burnett reporting.
Guerrillas in El Salvador today knocked out 40% of the nation's electric power lines and launched attacks on military positions in six towns. The attacks came one day after rebel leaders meeting in Mexico offered to stop fighting if elections are delayed. Rebel radio said four soldiers were killed and 21 injured in the attacks. The military did not release official casualty figures, but sources said one guerrilla was killed and two wounded. Soviet Foreign Minister Edward Shevardnadze today met in Cairo with his Israeli counterpart Moshe Arens and later with PLO leader Yasser Arafat. Shevardnadze said after the Arens meeting that peace in the Mideast will be impossible without Soviet participation or the goodwill of Israel. Arafat said he'd be willing to meet with Israeli officials before an international conference on Middle East peace, but Moshe Arens ruled out such a meeting because Israel considers as terrorist both Arafat and the PLO. And a Palestinian woman accused of collaborating with Israeli authorities was shot dead today in the Gaza Strip. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Sir Thomas Beecham was the most famous British conductor of the 20th century, famous not only for his musicianship, but also for his sharp wit. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review of two recent Beecham releases, one of them a live concert, and the other music by Grieg.
Sir Thomas Beecham was literally an aristocrat among conductors. To some critics, he was merely a talented amateur with an acid tongue. My own most vivid impression of him comes from the movie Unfaithfully Yours. Not the version with Dudley Moore, but the exhilarating Preston Sturges comedy with Rex Harrison. I don't think any film has ever used classical music with more inspired comic precision. Sturges clearly modeled Harrison's hilariously obsessive and iconoclastic Sir Alfred de Carter on Sir Thomas. When a reporter wants to know why Harrison conducts from a score, he witheringly replies, "Because I can actually read music." Edgar Kennedy plays a music-loving private eye. Harrison calls him a footpad. He effuses about Harrison's conducting. "Nobody handles Handel like you handle Handel. And you're Delius, delirious." Beecham did specialize in Handel and championed the eccentric, expatriate British composer Frederick Delius. Here's part of a live Beecham performance of Delius's atmospheric North Country sketches, recorded in real stereo in 1959, 2 years before Beecham's death, and recently issued on compact disc by the Music and Arts label. Beecham was famous for his Mozart and Haydn, but he was also admired for importing a more exotic repertory. French composers like Berlioz and Bizet, his great recordings of the Symphonie Fantastique and Carmen, are still available. Northern European composers like Grieg and Sibelius, and the Russians. Beecham's 1958 recording of Scheherazade, now on an Angel CD, is the most glamorous and exciting ever made. In 1932, he founded one of the world's great orchestras, the London Philharmonic. Many of his hand-picked players, like oboist Leon Goossens and clarinetist Reginald Kell, were distinguished soloists, and Beecham reveled in their individuality. If anything was more glorious than their ensembles, it was the solos. The London Phil was dissolved at the beginning of World War II. It's too bad none of their amazing recordings have been reissued on CD. Beecham's Peer Gynt suite, for example, not only revealed what a brilliant, evocative score this is, it's the only performance that makes me forget how I first learned it in elementary school, singing, "Morning is dawning and Peer Gynt is yawning and Grieg says get up and get out of your bed." Beecham spent most of the war years in America, then returned to England and started the Royal Philharmonic. In 1956, he recorded all the incidental music to Ibsen's play, and that's recently been reissued on an Angel CD, along with a Grieg symphonic dance and his early concert overture In Autumn. Here's some of Beecham's scintillating Anitra's Dance. Let's end with more music from the live 1959 concert, the end of the slow movement of Beethoven's Seventh Symphony. Beecham apparently never played anything the same way twice, but all his familiar trademarks are here: exhilarating rhythms, transparent textures, and a continual sense of surprise.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed two recent releases, Sir Thomas Beecham conducting Grieg on Angel Records and music of Beethoven, Mendelssohn, and Delius on the Music and Arts label. This is Fresh Air. Al Young is the author of three musical memoirs in which he says he uses music as a way of remembering. Every chapter is titled with a song. Every song triggers a memory. Young played guitar and sang before he turned to writing, but he's remained a devoted jazz listener, and jazz figures into much of his writing. He's a poet, novelist, and screenwriter, although most of his screenplays have remained unproduced. His new novel, Seduction by Light, is set in Hollywood. It's the story of a black woman whose career has gone from getting cast as maids in movies to actually working as a maid in the home of a white producer. I asked Al Young why he wanted to write a novel in her voice.
I wanted to write in her voice because that's the voice that suggested itself to me when I sat to try to capture something of the feelings that I had gathered from working in Hollywood intermittently as a screenwriter, and recalling that it had always been the staff people, that is, the valets, the maids, the cooks, the governesses, the chauffeurs, who stuck with me when I was in the big executives' homes and in the big stars' homes. They seem like the real solid, grounded people of Hollywood, if anything in Hollywood can be said to be grounded.
When you're writing in a character's voice, you try to really get their voice.
Oh, yes.
The cadences of the way they speak, the
absolutely
idiosyncrasies of their speech. And I'd really like to know why you're so interested in capturing that in dialogue.
It's because I grew up in Mississippi listening to natural storytelling, and in an extended family and community in which dozens, if not hundreds, but certainly dozens of people were excellent storytellers. And this was actually my primary literary influence, just listening to these tales and listening to the musicality of the voices, the cadences, the dynamics, so that when I sit to write, I have to get a voice. Even if I'm writing in the third person, there has to be a voice that's convincing before I can go forth with the story. And this is very different from the kinds of things that are usually taught in creative writing classes.
Let me ask you to read something in the voice of the main character of your new novel, Seduction by Light.
I'd love to. This is Mamie Franklin in Chapter 8 describing something of her career. Now, I'm going to do an abrupt change here, so I hope the mic levels are set right. Now, don't go getting me wrong now. I never had anything against Steppin' Fetchit or Clarence Muse or Butterfly McQueen, or Willie Bess, or Mantan Moreland, or Hattie McDaniels, or any of those old movie performers. After all, a gig is a gig. Those were great comedic actors, and they played their stuff to the hilt. In some of those old Step and Fetch It pictures, you can almost see the brother wanking at you as he wipes his hand across his mouth and whines in that slow molasses voice of his. Well, boss, I's gwine to de big ribber boat up yonder in heaven. But I just didn't happen to be all wrapped up and gung-ho to play those kind of roles. Even when I did play maids, and that's mostly what I played, I had to strain to try to bring a little dignity to the role. I haven't spent all that much time figuring it out, but you must admit that there's irony, as my boy Benji might put it, to my starting off playing domestics and then ending up being one in real life.
Really like the way you read that. It's very interesting to compare your actual speaking style to the style you've created for the character. I guess I was wondering if the music of that kind of language has a particular appeal for you.
Oh, yes, absolutely. This was actually my original language. And whenever I get back down south, as I do sometimes two and three times a year now, if you were to be invisible and trail me around, you would find me lapsing back into something that probably falls in between those two ways of speaking. I think like a lot of Americans who were not raised in the mainstream of our national life. I'm multilingual, certainly bilingual, and feel totally comfortable in at least two or three different idioms.
Mm-hmm. You've commented that in the late 1960s and in part of the early 70s, you were told by some friends, and I think some people in the publishing world as well, that your writing wasn't militant enough. And mm-hmm. I think one publishing company sent you a note saying that your novel was a little too sweet for a ghetto novel.
Those were the words.
What was perceived as the problem?
The problem was that I didn't fit into the packaging scheme. And at that time, black anger and black rage was being packaged. And I was a little offbeat. I was not concerned with being angry or with raging, but with telling the truth as I saw it from my own experience in the world. And because I've been said to have a gentle touch in my writing, editors have a hard time with it. They wanted books that said, essentially, "Honky, I'm going to cut your throat!" You know, and everyone gets this little bit of titillation and a little bit of a thrill hearing this angry, oppressed person rage a bit, and it assuages a little bit of guilt, and money is exchanged, changes hands, and business is done. So I didn't fit in, and that's what they were telling me at that time.
Well, you created a kind of militant alter ego for yourself named...
Yes.
Named O.O.
And during that same period, as a matter of fact.
Mm-hmm. And he's named O.O. Gabuga, and if you see O-O that on Gabuga. The page, it looks like Ooga Booga.
Yes.
Describe how he got his name, how you gave him that name.
His name comes from Ooga Booga, which is a phrase that we've inherited from, among other sources, the old Tarzan movies. And the old Tarzan movies usually had these extras, these black so-called natives who were, it's not commonly known, but were often jazz musicians. I talked recently with Red Callender in connection with a book that I'm doing on Charles Mingus that's coming out later this year. And he said, "Oh, yeah, we all used to sideline." He said sidelining was, you know, you pick up some extra money playing a native. And they would say things to Tarzan like, "Mbawa, uga buga." Now, Hugh Masekela, the trumpet player and singer from Johannesburg, who's lived in this country for many, many years, he told me about watching those old Tarzan movies as a kid in Johannesburg. And he thought that maybe on the continent of Africa, there was a tribe that carried on like this. He just didn't happen to know about it. So when he got to America, he made an album that you might be familiar with, I'm sure you are, called The Americanization of Ooga Booga. And I listened to it, and I said, "That's it. We need something to lighten up this heavy, militant trend that's going on here." And there were humorous things about all of that black rage and the way it was being marketed. So I invented this character named O.O. Gabuga and invented a biography for him. And he wrote some poems that have become classics. In fact, in many circles, he's better known than I am. And I'm looking forward to the day when I put out a collection of his wit and wisdom called It's O.O.
Can you quote one of the lines you've written for him?
Yes, he has a poem called The Old O.O. Blues that starts out with the lines, "Like right now it's the summertime and I'm so all alone, I gots to blow some funky ram on my mental saxophone. Brother Train done did his thing and so have Wes Montgomery, both heavyweights in the music ring. Now I'm gonna play my summary. It's lots of y'all that think y'all white, ought I say European, who think Mozart and Bach's all right, denying your black being. Well, honky files, y'all's day done come. I mean, we gon' clean house and rid this earth of Oreo scum that put down fats for Faust." That's the O.O. Gabuga style.
I'm wondering if your parody of that character has to do more with their politics or with their style.
No, I think it has to do with the human propensity for laughter. When anything becomes too fraudulent and too...
self-righteous?
Cooked. Uh-huh. I think that humor affords an escape valve. In the same way that Cervantes wrote Don Quixote to run the novel of chivalry out of town, because that had gotten underfoot and it had gotten to be corny, I was writing created O.O. Gabuga and writing his work to make fun not of genuine people who were fighting for civil rights or fighting for the thing that we black people have continued to fight for and will continue for a long time to fight for in this country, and that is equality. But there were a lot of people who were making a dollar off of it, both black and white, and I think that this had to be addressed in some way, and I thought that satire was the only way of doing it.
L. Young is a novelist, poet, and memoirist. His new novel, Seduction by Light, is published by Delta Fiction. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel is joining us from Washington, D.C. with a look at all things considered. Robert, I hear there's news that cost of living is up. Are you taking a look at the economy?
We will. We'll be talking with an economic forecaster about what the jump in the consumer price index means and why the stock market dropped in response to it. We'll also be hearing a new estimate of what President Bush's plan to bail out the savings and loans is going to cost over a number of years, and it's much, much higher than what we'd heard before. Also, a talk today with naturalist and very funny travel writer Redmond O'Hanlon about his trip through the Amazon. His last book was about Borneo, and this one's called In Trouble Again.
Thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Coke and Pepsi have been battling it out using pop stars as spokespeople for a while now, but the contest has recently taken a new turn. It's going international. Madonna is doing her part. She'll be debuting a piece from her new album in an international Pepsi commercial on March 2nd. Rod Stewart will be handling the market in Latin America with a new ad soon, and Robert Palmer will also be getting into the act. But while the two colas are accelerating their Star Wars, critic Leslie Savin says that at least Pepsi is doing the vital work of liberating the Soviet people.
Sometimes when you slurp or chew or otherwise transact, you're supposed to imbibe the good feelings of McDonald's community or Hallmark family. Other times, you're supposed to experience Michelob sex or American Express success. But now we're entering the 90s, and we're often told, we've got to get global. We've got to bond with our fellow humans. That is to say, now we should be feeling Pepsi. In an ad called Glasnost, Pepsi introduces itself as the psychic bridge between America and the Soviet Union. It's the effervescent gulp that can slosh together opposing forces.
Not very long ago, America introduced Pepsi to the Soviet Union. And while it may be just a coincidence, a lot of refreshing changes have taken place ever since.
The change taking place, according to this ad, the first ever filmed in Moscow, is that Russia is rocking out. While a teenage boy is bopping to punk, his father is at the table reading the paper until he just can't take the noise anymore.
Shum, shum, shum. Да почему столько шум?
That roughly translates into the old American battle cry, "You call that music?" Leather-jacketed longhairs on Red Square are skateboarding, boomboxing, slapping five, and drinking Pepsi. It's powerful, and it flatters us to no end when the wife of the disapproving dad hands him a Pepsi and coos, "Yuri, come on, lighten up." Pepsi has always been at the forefront of bringing capitalism in all its coolness to the Ruskies. In 1974, it became the first American consumer product sold, legally at least, in the USSR. Today, its trade with Russia is worth $2 billion. The Soviets pay for Pepsi syrup in Stolichnaya vodka, which is then distributed here. Now, the Glasnost spot might seem to trivialize an important issue. Peace on Earth, after all, does not come from a Pepsi bottle or even a pair of Levi's. But it is true that opening up trade can open up good feelings. In light of that, the ad will air internationally. But it's questionable whether it will be allowed in Russia itself. So, you might ask, how real is Pepsi's liberation of the Soviet people? Hey, loosen up, America. Pepsi isn't really trying to claim that it's won a psychosocial victory over the Politburo. You're just supposed to love them for having the chutzpah to say it. And if they pull it off with enough whimsy, then it might lower your skepticism. You might be more receptive to Pepsi's more ambiguous achievements, like laying on Russia the worst of corporate culture, rock and roll at the beck and call of the CEO. Pepsi got a Soviet rock group called Pogo to compose and perform the music for the ad. If you resent rock and roll selling out to capitalism here, what does this mean? An advertiser's big and credible claim can camouflage all sorts of smaller claims that it proposes as perfectly credible. Like, if a corporation plays rock and rock loosens you up, then the corporation's product will loosen you up. Or that, if the Russians yearn to be like us and drink like us, then we must be pretty great. And their bottom line is, after all our work at setting international lifestyle, we deserve a nice cold Pepsi.
Leslie Savin writes about advertising for The Village Voice. Here's a look at the next fresh air. Next time, big band music without nostalgia. Lauren Schoenberg talks with us about his repertory jazz band. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker has a roundup of recent cover recordings, and film critic Stephen Schiff reviews True Believer, starring James Woods and Robert Downey Jr. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Lisa Bruton, Phyllis Myers, and Amy Sallet. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Deborah Beagle. Research assistants from Christopher Cook and Sharon Sanders. Our engineer is Thad Kirk. Chris Burgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. NPR, National Public Radio.